From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's an LGBT Mormon organization called Affirmation, and they're just about to release a survey gauging the reaction to the LDS Church's polarizing policy that labeled Mormons and same-sex marriages apostates. The findings suggest, not surprisingly, feelings of hope dropped after the policy. Feelings of pain and loneliness went up. And this was interesting. The survey found the emotional and spiritual impact on the straight family and friends of these LGBT people was at least as intense and maybe even more so. People feel strongly about the policy. There have been mass resignations. There are stories of broken families. Some critics say it's led to increased youth suicides. Today in the program, we're continuing our conversation about the policy by talking about its impact. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's been a year now since a policy from leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was made public. Yesterday in the program, we discussed how that policy came about, and it was a conversation kind of about the political backstory to the policy, how there may have been differing factions within LDS Church leadership, how they discussed these different responses to the question of what to do with LGBT members of their church who wanted to live their lives true to their sexual identity, that is, have sexual relationships and get married. The policy, as you know by now, that they came up with classified same-sex Mormon couples as apostates and banned their children from baby blessings and baptisms. Today in the program, we're going to continue our conversation about that policy by exploring its impact on mainstream Mormons, on LGBT Mormons, on their families and friends. Peggy Fletcher Stack wrote a piece in the Salt Lake Tribune where she quoted some people who wondered if church leaders had lost their moral authority because of this decision. So is that true? Has the policy or the church's position caused broken families and increased the number of youth suicides? We'll begin today by getting some reaction to the policy from mainstream members, the rank and file. Earlier today, we spoke again with Richard Holtzapfel, who is a professor of church history at Brigham Young University, also a stake president in Provo. And we asked Brian Grimmett to join us. You may remember Brian as a reporter for KUER for a few years. He's now left journalism. He's working in Kansas City these days. But Brian is an active Latter-day Saint, and he agreed to offer some on-the-ground perspective. I began by asking Professor Holtzapfel how he reacted when the policy was made public a year ago.
I think the policy has had an impact on North American Mormons, principally Canadians and Americans, because of what's going on in our culture right now. The struggle we have, at least that's the sense I've had with my students and people I associate with, my own family discussions, is how do we remain loyal to a principle yet ensure that we are sensitive to the pains and frustrations of others. And certainly this caused us, because this is an official policy statement that we sustain, because we believe our prophets can see around the corner. We support them. We act in faith. But still, how do we work this out in real life? When it comes down to a sister, a nephew, a friend, another person. So, yeah, I think the official announcement certainly cause us all pause to think on those very hard, difficult, as we're trying to figure out our way on this.
Brian, one of the things you've told us is that for general members of the church, not members who consider themselves progressive or plugged into the Mormon blogosphere or who may be questioning their relationship with the church, but rank-and-file members who just, as you sort of put it to us, just go to church on Sunday, nobody you know of really thinks that much about the policy anymore. Is that true?
Yeah, it's not something that even really comes up in conversations very much anymore. I remember when it first came out, yeah, we talked about it and talked about how you know, how it happened and what maybe the impacts would be. But, you know, now a year out later, even 6 months later, we go to church, we go to Sunday, and we're not focused on LGBT policy. We're not focused on any of the church's policies. We're really focused on, you know, the stuff that you get taught in Sunday school, which is, you know, gospel principles, you know, the basic stuff, faith, repentance, Jesus Christ, the atonement, that kind of thing. So it's not something, at least in my experience, that we really do focus on a lot. And maybe that's bad. Maybe we should focus on a little bit more, but that's but it's just, it's not at the forefront of our minds.
So, Professor Holdzapfel, I wanted to ask you to respond to what Brian just said. And as he said, is that as it should be, that sort of mainstream go to church on Sunday people don't spend that much time thinking about this policy? I mean, just from a Christian sort of compassion standpoint, you do have some of your fellow saints who, as you sort of mentioned earlier, are profoundly affected by this. Should you be spending more time thinking about it?
If we take the ministry of Jesus seriously, if we take the text seriously, it's clear that Jesus not only preached and taught, he also healed. His was a healing ministry, and I think he was known for that. And that forces us to ask real questions about our own discipleship, just the humanness of it all. There are people who are isolated, who are lonely, people who are worried, and maybe we need to do more to search them out, ask some questions, listen. I think it is our Christian duty to talk about it appropriately. There's certainly the core message of the gospel that's got to be our focus, but Jesus seems to have gone out and looked for people who were marginalized, who were struggling, who were feeling lonely. And I think maybe we need to do a better job on that part.
Brian, does it matter to the rank-and-file Latter-day Saint like yourself how it played out, in the sense that you have leaders going through this kind of political process, this kind of give and take where they may not always be in agreement about a particular thing? Did it matter to you that it played out like that, or that it does seem to play out like that?
Well, it's kind of hard to generalize about that, because I think we all have kind of our different knowledge about how that kind of thing works. I mean, with my background as a reporter, I kind of look to know how those things work, and so I was familiar with it beforehand, and so for me, I've kind of internalized that these are just men. The church is they're more than men, but in the end, they're men. They're running a church. They're running an organization. It's full of bureaucracy. So I've come to terms with that. And I think a lot of the general Mormons, at least I talk to at least family members who aren't really that involved in lots of different things. They just kind of live their lives. Not that that's a bad thing, but they don't think about it too much. And so when they hear that that's how it goes, the reactions kind of differ. A lot of it is defensive position of how the church works, because they go on faith. They sustain these men as prophets, literally people who receive the will of God. And so when they come out with a decision, they don't really think about how it happened. They just think that, okay, even if I struggle with it, I believe these men were called of God, so I'm going to try to follow what they've told me to do.
Professor, there's been some talk about younger Mormons, how they're taking all of this. They're, in some cases, as it's sort of as a generation, you know, the millennials or whatever, that they're troubled by this decision more than others might be. But that seems really hard to pin down. The Mormon scholar Jana Reese just released this preliminary data from a survey that she had done on how young Mormons are thinking about the policy. And she found that among active LDS millennials in the United States, 72% either strongly agree or somewhat agree with the part of the policy that defines same-sex couples as apostates. Now, it goes down a bit when you throw in the part that bars children from blessings and baptisms, but that goes down to 63%. But that still, some would say, is kind of high. So is that, from your perspective, significantly high or low, or what do you make of that?
Well, I was not surprised by the study. I think, like lots of members of the church, this group who are committed, active Latter-day Saint millennials, they believe that God is called a prophet, and that sometimes we don't understand their guidance. Sometimes it's difficult. It seems counterintuitive to what we feel, and we accept it in faith and patience, and we believe, I think, this generation believes that God will work it out, that he is patient with us as humans, that he's long-suffering, and that there's a light at the end of the tunnel as we keep taking steps forward, moving forward. So I think the study reveals certainly a millennial attitude of tolerance. You know, they were taught by parents and grandparents that, you know, from the 1960s of racism, and we need to be open, we need to be tolerant. And so they've applied it to almost every aspect. So there's a little difference between their generation. I think it's a paradigm shift from my generation, my parents' generation. But yet that high percentage who somewhat accept this, I think they're accepting it on faith, that we, as in the past and now, we act on faith on this and somehow believe that God's moving the church in a way that he is appropriate, and we need to be patient with that. So I think that's probably a I agree with her analysis of the situation, and I think it's pretty reflective, at least my experience with college students.
But Brian, then you have nearly 30% who say they're not crazy about the part one or part two of that policy, the apostate part or the children part. If you're a church leader, if you're a member of the hierarchy, does that 30% worry you in some way?
I think it's, I mean, not that I can speak for
no,
church leadership, but I think even from a local perspective, even as each of us members, as we try to look out for those within the flock, so to speak, I think we are concerned about that. I know several of my friends who have kind of slowly backed away from the church because of their positions on same-sex marriage and homosexuality, and that's tough. Again, I think it goes back to what we talked to earlier about trying to find that balance. The church has, for a long time, has had this position on same-sex marriage. It's not new, their opposition to it. And so trying to balance that and the idea that it is sinful in the eyes of God with the compassion that we've also been commanded to have, I think it's hard to find that. It's hard to know where that is. And so it does seem almost duplicitous. On one hand, the church is saying, you know, people who enter into same-sex marriage are apostates. But on the other hand, we want to reach out to you and welcome you into the church. And maybe it is, but I think there is kind of this balance, because the church and Christ himself teaching was all about reaching out to those and asking them to follow him, to make those changes in their lives. And it does come down to patience, which I think is kind of hard for millennials to have, is to kind of look at the long game instead of what are you doing for me right now? And what are you doing for me right now is pushing me away.
This may seem like a redundant question, but I'm wondering, has the policy raised questions of doubt for those rank and file members we referred to earlier? Because Brian, you've suggested that many of the people who are really troubled by this are sort of, as you put it, already on their way out of the church anyway.
I think a lot of them are. I wouldn't say that all of them are. I mean, I think there are people who were faithful before and had no problem with the church's positions, but I think this policy did have an impact on them. I don't want to group everyone into, oh, well, you know, they were already on their way out.
Yeah.
But so it is tough. It's this weird, there is a lot of compassion for members of the church. And I think that's where that tension is this desire to love others. And so they see this policy as being contrary to that. I don't personally see it as that way, and maybe I've rationalized it away, but I accept Elder Christofferson's explanation, rationalization of it.
Professor, I want to hear you on that.
Yeah, I think this is a really good question. I think certainly my experience, again, you know, basically is teaching college-age students and being involved with college-age students, members of the church, is that the policy did one thing. It definitely sent a clear signal of what the church's position on same-sex marriage is. But at the same time, the question becomes now, how do we implement it in our daily life when we think of the LGBTQ community? I mean, how do we do that? And I think when they first read the newspaper accounts, the spins in the newspaper, in the media, there were serious questions. But I think as they reflected upon church's discussion of the topic, particularly I think Elder Christofferson's interview, they, I think, had this idea. I trust these men. We know they're human, but we also have to be honest that we've seen when God touches them, and that's that kind of counterplay between it's all secular or it's all religious. Well, it's in between. We're humans working through this. And so I think the interpretation that the policy protects children from conflicts in their family on faith, matters of faith, children are not shut out, they're actually invited. And there's a path that allows for future ordinances. I think many have worked that out. Now, I've actually seen from college students that as they're thoughtful and thinking about this, that they've been able to somehow put this into their belief system, that it's not the reason they're members of the church, they're not active members because of this policy, but they're active members because of their faith commitment to serve others, to be kind, to follow the teachings of Jesus. So I think those part of the millennials are hanging in there.
Richard Holzapfel is a professor of church history at Brigham Young University. We also heard from Brian Grimmett, who is a former KUER reporter, joined us both earlier this morning. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are going to continue a conversation we started yesterday about the LDS Church's controversial policy declaring Mormon same-sex couples apostates. Yesterday, we talked about how the policy came about. Today, we're shifting to the question of the impact of it all. Joining us on the program, again, is Kendall Wilcox. He's a documentary filmmaker, Mormon LGBT activist, working on a project called Far Between, which explores what it means to be gay and Mormon. And Kendall Wilcox, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
John DeLynn is with us here in the studio, a psychologist as well as creator of the very popular Mormon Stories podcast. It's a podcast that looks at LDS faith and culture. John's research focuses on the intersection of mental health and religion and on the LGBTQ Mormon experience. And John DeLynn, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
We also have with us John Gustav Rothel, who is president of Affirmation. That's a support group for LGBT Mormons. He also teaches American religious history at the United Theological Seminary in Minnesota. Gustav Rothel is himself a gay man, has been excommunicated from the LDS Church, still active in his ward, though, and he's joining us from a studio in Minneapolis. And John Gustav Rothel, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Doug.
I want to begin by getting you to react to what you're hearing from mainstream Latter-day Saints about all of this. What we were hearing from Richard and Brian earlier, that mainstream Latter-day Saints, look, this is a thing for LGBT Mormons and for their families and allies and sort of a niche group. But that's about it. Most mainstream Mormons aren't sitting around parsing this policy, aren't wringing their hands about any of this. John DeLynn, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it really, this doesn't really hit you until it hits you.
But you agree personally with that. You think mainstream Mormons aren't really thinking about that.
Yeah, I think number one, their ethic is follow the brethren. The brethren have spoken, and that's their decision. And then it only touched them. You know, they're running people to soccer practice. They're having their day jobs. They're fulfilling their callings. Unless they have someone really close to them, really in pain, they're just not going to think much about it.
Kendall?
Totally agree. I mean, even the data, you know, supports this. You know, the couple of studies that have been done on people's reactions to this show that mainstream Mormons, just as John has said and others have said, might have heard about it, might have heard rumors even, and thought it was just a rumor, and then moved on. You know, even Elder Oaks has said publicly on at least a couple of occasions that this only impacted a relatively small number of Mormons. So let's move on.
There was a story in the Salt Lake Tribune this morning. Peggy Fletcher Stack wrote this piece, which quotes the LDS Church as saying, and I want to quote them here, "The number of people asking to have their names removed from the records of the church has been less than 0.1%, and that number has sort of been consistent for the last couple of decades, especially or including anyway the first 8 months of this year." The implication being, of course, that okay, there were some, you know, there was a little bit of a hubbub when this thing came out, and there was some people who did resign for sure. But look, this is not that big of a deal. It isn't really affecting that many people. I want to get you all to react to that. And John Gustav Rothel, maybe you can jump in first on that one.
Well, yeah, you know, I was going to say I think I agree, but with a caveat here. I think that it's true, and I attend church regularly, and I go to sacrament meeting and Sunday school and priesthood meeting, and you know, no, it's not a topic of conversation, and yes, we are, you know, really sort of focused on the basics of the gospel. But I think there is a caveat in that when people's lives intersect with an LGBT person, then I think that there's a sort of space of cognitive dissonance, and people know where the church is with this, but when they have to actually interact with somebody, that I think that's where doubt is created and where there's a little bit more struggle. And so I think that while a lot of people have moved on, and I, you know, I suspect that what Peggy Fletcher Stax found is true. I from the very beginning, I doubted that there would be, you know, large numbers of resignations over this. I think most of the people who resigned were folks who had already kind of quit. But I agree. That doesn't surprise me. And I think that most people have moved on. But I think the event, you know, it created an impression that's there somewhere. Hmm. And then when they have to engage with somebody, it brings it forward. And my impression is that people do and will struggle with it as they interact with real LGBT people.
I want you guys to talk about that too. Does that depress you? That in some ways, okay, you're these little group of outliers, and most people, they've moved on. This is deeply meaningful to you. You think it's having a profound effect on the lives of people, and we'll get to that. But you're outliers. Go ahead.
And yeah. Even to tag off of what John was saying, people at some point or another are confronted by some sort of dissonance, right? The empathy that they feel for LGBT people to one degree or another and the doctrines of the church, there's dissonance there. But again, we go back to the majority look to the words of the brethren or the church and find pretty quick resolution or at least sufficient resolution for themselves on this issue and move on. So again, we sort of go back to sort of status quo.
But Kendall, doesn't that make you feel hopeless?
It's a hard for me to gauge.
I mean, if there's not a churn going on within the mainstream church,
right.
you don't have a chance.
It's well, that's not true. But it's hard for me to gauge my own feelings about it because I'm so dang used to it. Like I'm immune. I'm inured to it. And in the face of that reality that I have come to completely acknowledge and accept, I'm going to keep pressing. I'm going to keep working.
John Dillard, what do you think?
I just did what's 0.1%. It's about 16,000 a year. There's a lawyer named Mark Noggle in Salt Lake City who's been processing resignations since November of 2015, and I've heard tens of thousands have been processed. So I would just challenge the church to publish those numbers because my experience on the street is that that's not true. But I'll just also add. Whether it's my friend Tyler Glenn, whether it's a lot of high-profile Mormons, whether it's thousands of Mormons that I've spoken with who have left since the November decision, a lot of people don't actually make the effort to resign because it'll hurt grandma's feelings or hurt mom and dad's feelings or they just don't want to bother. So I would guess that the impact of this in terms of church membership and activity is much deeper than just what the resignations themselves
indicate.
And
impossible to measure. Here's one thing I wanted to get you all to respond to, too. There's this sense that, and I've heard people sort of speak hopefully, that this new younger generation has a different attitude about same-sex marriage and the gay people that are now, you know, out and among them. I mentioned earlier Mormon scholar Jana Rees released this preliminary data that said active LDS millennials, 72% either strongly agreed or somewhat agreed with the policy, that first policy that called people apostates. What do you think about that?
Well, the statistic that I've heard is that something like 2/3 of all millennials within the LDS church are inactive. So they're starting with a really small base. I can't stop hearing from my sister and apologists about how we're losing the millennials in droves. So if you're starting with a really depleted number, then maybe, yeah, those who are remaining are going to follow the brethren. But to say that we don't have a crisis amongst millennials, I think is sort of the king having no clothes sort of language.
Yeah, I agree, because my understanding also of the surveys, the internal surveys that the church has done with different demographics within the church, and particularly within the millennials, is that it's well known or understood that, in a sense, the church has lost them on this issue. And those are you know, surveys done within the membership of the church, people who actually proactively respond to these surveys for the church. So,
John, go ahead. I don't know what those statistics are.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be, you know, John has a point. I don't know if those statistics take account for that, but it seems to me like there is and there will continue to be cognitive dissonance about this. And I think that that's ultimately what's going to drive this. I think that that encounter between faithful Latter-day Saints, many of whom are LGBT, and the experience of LGBT people, which doesn't, you know, I think that in our survey we found so many people who rejected the policy. The vast majority of the people who responded on our survey rejected the policy. And of course, that's the LGBT community and people who are aligned with them and know them and love them well. And I think the reason for that is because it runs so fundamentally contrary to our core experience of who we are, not only who we are, but our spirituality and our relationship with God. So many LGBT individuals have had profound spiritual experiences of acceptance from God. And the experience that they have just doesn't fit with the policy. And so a lot of LGBT folks are like, the policy can't be true. It can't work. So there's this, you know, this core cognitive dissonance, and I think that as people engage with and encounter LGBT Mormons, that the cognitive dissonance comes to the fore, and you have to struggle with this. So whatever those numbers are now, I think that as there continues to be a deepening dialogue, we're going to see change around this.
I want to ask you about the survey, John Gustav Rothel, that you conducted with Affirmation, releasing this weekend. I want to talk about a few things, if it's okay, in that survey.
Sure.
You talked about wanting to sort of quantify the social impact, the emotional and spiritual impact of the policy. And so you had, I think it was 900 completed surveys.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So about that.
I guess we can't – it's sort of self-selected. We can't necessarily – we can't call it scientific, but I think it's
–
well, let's sort of use that as a caveat and find out what you learned. And I wanted to begin with that question of God, how people, LGBT Mormons, for example, and their family members are thinking about God, because one thing you found in the survey is that a number of people reported obviously having a faith crisis as a result of this.
Right.
And it also changed the way they saw God. What can you say about what you learned in that respect?
Yeah. So, like, one of the things that I was very interested in looking at in our data and what we were able to do is sort of look at different groups of people. And there were people who had already been disaffected from the church before the policy, and the policy kind of confirmed their general impression of the church. We had people who were loyal to the church before the policy and became disaffected as a result of the policy. And we had people who were loyal to the church before the policy and remained loyal after the policy. And in that second group of people, the folks who had become disaffected from the church because of the policy, when we asked them questions about their relationship with God or their belief in God, we saw a really dramatic loss of faith in God among this group of people. And when you look at the group of people who remained loyal to the church, there was no loss of faith in God at all. In fact, if we tried to look at, like, you know, what correlated most strongly with remaining connected to and remaining loyal to the church, it was that question of their relationship to God. If you looked at the question of their level of trust in the brethren, we saw a significant loss of trust in the brethren in both of those groups, both among those who stayed loyal to the church and among those who left the church. So if people were staying, it wasn't necessarily because they were walking lockstep with the brethren and saying, you know, whatever the brethren say, that's what we believe, that's what we accept. That is apparently not what was keeping people loyal to the church. What was keeping them connected to the church was their relationship with God. And the conclusion that I draw from that is that if your relationship with God is filtered through the church leadership, then when there is something that causes you to question what's going on with the church leadership or you have doubts about the leadership, your faith in God sort of falls. It's the next domino to tumble. But if your relationship with God is primary and if it's independent and you have a strong personal relationship with God, whatever your feelings may be about the leaders, you're much more likely to stay loyal to the church.
John DeLino, what do you think about that idea? Because this question of who you're loyal to, your concept of God, or is this faith in a church, in a group of men, or something more particular to God?
I think a belief in God is part of it. I also think we can't undervalue the importance of family and community. Who wants to separate from their tribe? Who wants to disappoint their parents and their siblings? Who wants to be separated from the faith community that is their language? Even the hymns. I'm an excommunicated Mormon, and when I hear Come, Come, You Saints, the hair still stands up on my arms. Right. And so, yeah, whether or not you retain belief in the Restoration or the Book of Mormon as a historical document or Thomas S. Monson as someone who really talks to God, you can try and go to other churches. But one thing we find from just general LDS disaffection research is that most people who leave the LDS church either become atheist or agnostic and don't reaffiliate with any religious tradition. There's something about Mormonism that is so beautiful or powerful or compelling that you either stay with it or you never go anywhere else.
I want to play a clip. And Kendall, I want to bring you in on this. This is a piece of tape. Her name is Marley.
Yeah.
Would you set this up for us? Because I think what's interesting here, she talks about her concept of God. And maybe tell us, you've been collecting these clips. We're going to play a few as we go along today, but tell us a little bit about the different kinds of voices you've been collecting along the way.
Sure, yeah. So this is part of the Out in Zion podcast project, where I've gone and tried to really find a broad spectrum of responses to the policy over the last year. And so Marley, I actually met her last year right after the policy. A friend of mine and I organized these living room conversations to just get people together with really diverse reactions and just to sit together and listen to each other. And in one of those, she and her newlywed husband were there, and she just started to pour her heart out, and she burst forth with so much emotion and anger and frustration because her backstory is her parents married, dad didn't come out as gay until she was 3. They held on until she was about 8, and then got divorced. Then she was, you know, co-parented by straight mom in the church, dad who eventually did leave the church and found a partner, and she was raised in that context, sort of the very context of the church through this policy was saying would not be good for children. And she felt so rejected, in a sense even mocked, by the underlying supposition of the policy that she reacted in all sorts of ways.
The God that I know is loving and inclusive, and it seemed like there was none of that in this. And it made me mad that God would allow the brethren to do this and to say that it came from God. And how can these men who know Christ personally and are the most Christ-like men on earth, how can they do this? Growing up with a gay father and loving the church and believing in the church, I just kind of developed this gray space where I was comfortable believing in the church, but also believing that my dad deserved love and happiness. And this policy felt like the connection between my spiritual brain and my temporal brain was just completely severed. And I had to decide which side I wanted to be on. And that was extremely difficult for me.
John Gustav Rothel, you've talked about, this was really interesting in the survey, the emotional impact and the spiritual impact on friends and families of LGBT people was, as you say, at least as intense and possibly more intense
yes.
than the impact on LGBT individuals. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and that part of the survey really reinforced my experience. I remember in the immediate aftermath of the policy talking to LGBT Mormons, and a lot of them, you know, this felt like, you know, par for the course for a lot of them. It hurt really bad, but, you know, in a way they were sort of prepared for it. The family members, the straight family members, were devastated. And I remember talking to a millennial gay man and sort of checking in with him and asking him, how are you doing? And he said, I'm okay. And minutes later, I, you know, talked to his brother. And his brother was just I could hear it in his voice. He just was so low. And I think that, you know, a lot of straight family, their great dream, their great hope is to keep their forever family together within the church. And I think that there were some rising hopes. People were hoping that the church might be moving in a direction that would allow them to keep their families together. And when the policy hit, a lot of them were just like, oh, that's it. We've just lost our gay family member is lost to the church, and now we have to decide what we're going to do and what our relationship with the church is going to be. And it was just it was really rough.
There's a part in your survey where you find that 48% of LGBT people said they felt a sense of hope before the policy, after only 18%.
Right. Yeah. Dramatic decrease in hope, dramatic increase in sadness, feelings of sadness and depression. There was a really intense emotional impact. I think across the board, again, I think the folks on the end of that spectrum who I would, you know, describe as more having that relationship with God, those individuals tended to be, you know, a little bit more emotionally resilient, tended to be less negatively impacted by the policy. As part of our survey, we asked for qualitative stories, people to just tell their story, and we got quite a few stories of individuals talking about how when they learned about the policy, it was really devastating. And at some point, they came to God about it, and they asked for help, and they got an answer from God, and often that answer was, I'm with you. You're going to be okay. Don't worry about this. And people received a sense of comfort from that. So we've seen that, but even those individuals were struggling, and there was definitely a really difficult emotional impact.
But did they say? Could you discern whether or not what they thought the message from God was saying is, "Hey, everything's going to be okay. Stay being a Mormon." Because I think this is where I want to bring John DeLynn on this question, because I think John, some of the stuff that you've been studying is that's not healthy. And if you don't have a safe space in your religious place, then go somewhere else.
Yeah, we surveyed 1,612 LGBT Mormons and post-Mormons before the policy.
Right.
I have to assume that if the church was hostile then, it might be more now perceived. But a couple things that we know from the research, and this first part isn't for mine. Caitlin Ryan, you've had her on before. She says one of the biggest determinants in whether people engage in risky sexual behavior, drug use, and an eightfold increase in likelihood of attempting suicide is whether or not the person experiences family rejection. Do we think this policy is going to lead to families rejecting their kids more or less? I think the answer is probably more, because now same-sex marriage has been categorized as next to, child abuse, murder, et cetera. And it's been built into a default category for apostasy. So I have to think that families are going to be more, not less, rejecting of their kids now that the stakes have been raised. But we also see that the two healthiest things from our study that people can do are, number one, leave the church. And that's the majority of people. Not everyone benefits, but overall, lowest depression, highest self-esteem, highest quality of life comes after leaving the church and after getting legally same-sex married. That's the best outcomes. Is the church encouraging that? Probably not. And so what's difficult for me is that religion is usually a very positive thing from a psychological perspective. And so,
as long as it's safe.
As long as it feels safe and people feel welcome. And so what the church has done, so there's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, if the church is hostile, in a way they've done some of their LGBT members a favor by just saying get out and go get healthy. But on the other hand, people shouldn't have to choose between their faith and their tradition and their sexuality. And the actual best outcome we had for a very small group, 4% of our participants, was if they could be openly LGBT and embrace that and remaining in their church. Yeah. But how many wards are left where you can be openly even married LGBT and active in the church? Because now the policy makes it so bishops and stake presidents have to call a court on you if you find someone you love and marry them.
I want to play John Gustav Rothel. You want to say something to that? Because, well, I did sort of lead with that question for you about what, how they perceived what God was telling them.
Yeah, and so I think, again, we found that there was quite a bit more emotional resilience among this group of people who had a very close relationship with God, and so I think that, you know, where we might see the relationship with the church being unhealthy is where LGBT individuals are filtering their ideas about God through the leadership of the church and through the policy. And it could be that is damaging. But I think that when people are connected to God and they have a really strong relationship there, I think that's where you do see people being able to navigate that it looks like a difficult balancing act of affirming themselves as gay or lesbian or bi or transgender and being able to embrace their faith. You can do both, but the key is that relationship with God.
And I'm sure you know this, John. The only challenge with that is that the LDS Church teaches that whether it is by my voice or by the voice of my servants, it is the same. We're taught that the prophets and the apostles are the mouthpieces of God. And so how can a young LGBT person not intermingle his or her faith in God with the men who they are taught speak for God? How do they disentangle that and remain LDS? I think that's the great challenge.
I want to ask.
It is a challenge, but people do it. It's doable.
I want to ask a question. John, you alluded to this earlier, the question of what those sort of impacts might be. And this is a big question. Can you say, any of you, that there have been has been a measurable increase in youth suicides or any kind of suicides in the Mormon gay community related to this policy? Can anyone say?
That is a very, as we all know, it's a very sticky question.
Yeah.
because we have, you know, the story that emerged after the policy last year into the beginning of this year of sort of the anecdotal, and I don't mean that disparagingly necessarily, but anecdotal evidence of...
It's hard to find a causal connection.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
You know, state agencies don't measure for religion or for, specific religion at least, or for sexual orientation or gender expression. So it's really hard to find actual good numbers on that. And, excuse me, sorry. Anecdotally, yes, within our community, we have a sense that there is an increase. But then to create this sort of single narrative that being gay plus Mormon plus youth equals inevitable suicide. That is not factually true, based on data that is – it's just self-evident. The majority of us gay Mormons survive. I mean, that's the truest version of the narrative. We survive.
But what's your hunch, Kendall? Are more people killing themselves because they're losing hope with this policy?
No, I got to be honest.
You don't think? John Dolan, no. Do you think?
I think we've seen an uptick. I think, you know, the Mama Dragons have chronicled dozens. But Kendall's right. It's sophisticated. It's complicated. Yeah. We want to be careful. And we don't want to send a message of inevitability. And so I would say, yes, an uptick. But we have to be careful how we talk about it.
Yeah, it's the dangers of that single narrative that I just can't overemphasize is so dangerous to continually perpetuate this idea that all gay Mormons will kill themselves. That is dangerous to those who are already at a vulnerable state. Yes, because a lot of us gay Mormons do experience increased levels of depression. That is factually established. So to then add an additional risk factor is dangerous.
And there's a contagion element where the more you talk about you sometimes increase its inevitability.
That's important to say.
What we have documented and what Affirmation has documented with this survey is that there was an emotional impact. There was a negative emotional impact. There was an increase in people's sadness, feelings of depression. There was a decrease in feelings of hopefulness. So we know that there was an emotional impact. And that has an impact.
I want to play another moment. This is an anonymous gay man. Kendall Wilcox, will you set this up for us? This is a terrible story.
Yeah, this man actually grew up Mormon, very active in the Mormon community throughout most of his life, and actually participated heavily in Evergreen International, which was this earlier iteration of the church's gay Mormon organization to help
but this
people.
This is debunked now, reparative therapy.
Yes, yeah. But participated heavily there for years and years, tried, in a mixed orientation marriage, meaning his wife was straight, had two kids, they are now divorced. And then, depending on how much we'll hear of the clip, the day of the policy happened, and this is what happened.
So when the evening in November 6th, the policy announcement was made, I had barely become aware of it that evening. And then about 7 p.m., I got a text from my son, and he said, "Dad, I disavow you. I don't want to ever see you again. This is what the Lord wants. This is what the prophet wants me to do." About 20 minutes later, my daughter, she wrote a similar text, but she didn't give any explanation. She just said, "Dad, I disavow you." And they have not seen me since. So it's now been just about a year, just shy of a year since that policy announcement. And I've seen them twice. They haven't spoken to me. I text, I send emails, I leave phone messages. Those words were extremely painful. I mean, I cried for 2 hours.
It's just sort of an excerpt from that story. Some of the ones that is that an outlier? That particular story being rejected by family, or is this? Are you saying that is somewhat typical in some way?
Well, it depends.
John Dolan made this point. If their leaders now say this is God's will, this is what we want. I mean, and the word disavowal. Disavow is the word that is used for when these young children of same-sex couples come of age at 18, in order for them to receive these ordinances and things like that, they have to disavow. That was the word I think that was used.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because Elder Christofferson in the video release that sort of help members process this, they even brought up that idea, that word, and they sort of very quickly said, "Well, of course we don't disavow them as people, but I wanted to scream and say, well, back it up. Who even knows what that means, really, in a family relationship? How do you disavow somebody else or the practice of their marriage?" So of course, for a child or an adolescent, this is how they process it, and given all the other mitigating factors in a relationship like this, disavowal, how do we make sense of that word?
I agree with that. I mean, I think it's a really good example of how the policy communicated a whole constellation of unintended ideas, and I think the church leadership did try to, you know, draw that line and say we're talking about disavowing same-sex marriage. We're not talking about disavowing gay parents. But here we have an example of kids who heard the policy and said, "Okay, we've got to disavow our parents," and the church has done a really good job in the last year of drawing a line that looks like it's designed to protect the church from gay people. And there hasn't been a lot of effort to address, you know, those ways in which people will interpret the policy that's damaging and that is harmful and that was not ostensibly intended by the policy.
We're running out of time. I don't have 6 hours like John Delinda's in this podcast. I'm just going to say that we're going to run a little bit long because I want to sort of wrap up with another piece of tape. And Kendall Wilcox set this up for us. This is Laurie. Mm. She's lesbian, but she's married to a man. She's in this mixed orientation marriage that you're seeing some of in some religions, including Mormonism.
Exactly, yeah. And she's featured on the church's new Mormon and gay website. And she actually doesn't identify as lesbian anymore. She doesn't even identify as same-sex attracted, even though she was in a same-sex relationship for years. And she's married to a man. But what she sets up, I think, it helps us empathize with sort of the other side of the coin here of those who are, as you'll hear say, those who are trying to live the gospel as gay Mormons and the pressure that they're feeling and that therefore the brethren are also feeling about trying to make it clear about what God wants us to do with our lives.
My support of, you know, not only the gospel, but that I support and sustain the brethren is hard. And I know that people, LGBT people, you know, can see that as a slap in the face or, you know, I feel bad about that. I know it's hard and that's why I admire anyone who is in a same-sex relationship that still wants to come to church. I think that the rest of us should be not only tolerant, but admire their determination to try to, you know, remain faithful in whatever ways they can and are and still hold the faith.
Okay, I want to wrap this up, and I want to have you all respond to this. John Delinda, I want to start with you because your study about mixed orientation marriages is pretty striking. The rates of divorce, depression, identity distress, quality of life. This particular point you said, and though being in a mixed orientation marriage and being celibate is worse than lupus. Let me just set this up so you can respond to it, all of you. Is it better to I know people are struggling. Kendall, you, in your particular case, you want to try to make this work other people. But John, what do you say? Do you say, look, if you can't, you should leave if you want to be happy? I mean,
yeah, two things. There are going to be people who find joy in celibacy or joy in mixed orientation marriage. We don't want to discount that.
Right.
But on average, the majority find those lifestyles to be toxic. And when I look at the Mormon and gay website, it distresses me that the church doesn't provide any alternatives other than celibacy and mixed orientation marriage. And I ask, if we're a church based on prophecy, why can't we talk to God and find out a path for our LGBT members that isn't toxic, but that also allows them to be their full self? That's what I would love to see, is just give us something, give them something that they can choose. Because right now, I don't think they have any viable option.
And my first thought that comes to my mind is one man's toxic is another man's challenge from God to really prove ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that, to a large extent, is the role of religion in our lives for a lot of people, right? Is to test ourselves to see how much we can, in a sense, bend our will to the will of God and thereby grow and develop in ways that we can't even imagine. So,
but you don't think the will of God is for you not to have a sexual identity here on the earth?
I'm still investigating that.
Okay, yeah.
And it's not having a sexual identity here on earth. That's not what the church is saying.
You can't have sex.
Yeah, that's not necessarily identity, though.
No, that's true. I'm sorry, and I'm not. I'm not being argumentative,
okay.
But I'm saying that is,
okay.
That is, yeah.
Yeah, and so for me, this is a question about our moral responsibilities, about what we bring into this big conversation, right? What we're contributing and how we're influencing the conversation, and that's a huge, yeah, that's another 6-hour episode. But to me, that is the critical point. And just to bring it back to Lori, just to reflect on what she was saying, here's a woman who represents a huge swath of this particular niche community, yeah. Who felt that by seeing all these other gay Mormons who were being accepted, which people like me and saying, hallelujah, these same-sex couples are being celebrated in their church, in their ward congregations. But for people like her, they're saying, ouch, that hurts. I'm trying to do what the brethren are teaching me to do. And these people over here are being celebrated in big ways, and I'm not.
Wow.
And so I understand that pain, and yet to also, this is why I honor somebody like her who says in the same breath, and yet at the same time, she said, I think those who are choosing to come, who are in same-sex relationships and sticking out with the church and finding ways to integrate, she's celebrating them as well. So she's acknowledging, this is hard for me,
yeah.
And at the same time, I think they do deserve yeah. love and support. So that's the kind of contribution I hope we would all bring to this kind of conversation.
John Gustav Rothel, you get the final word.
You know, I would say the majority of LGBT Mormons have experienced intense, intense pain around this. And what I would want to say to those folks is I left the church for 19 years and was extremely happy. And I had a relationship with God that carried me and I found happiness and I thrived. And I think that people who are in such intense pain, I think the healthiest thing that many people can do is to step away and take some time to clear out toxic images of God, toxic ideas about spirituality and learn who you are and learn what your relationship with the divine is, and let that guide you. And I think that that's the most important thing that anybody can do right now. And what people need to know is that I know that you can be happy outside of the church if that's what you need to do, that you can find God and you can have a very fulfilling spiritual life and you can learn and grow. And that's what happened to me. And I found my husband, and I have a wonderful, almost 25-year relationship with him that continues to grow and amaze me every day. And so I think people need to do what they need to do to be healthy and to be happy. And it's the rest of our job, whether we're in the church, whether we're devout believers, it is or not, it is our job to support and love people. And I think that's, you know, some of the message that we're hearing from the church leadership now, too, is I think one of the good messages on the New Mormon and Gay website is that we have a responsibility to love everybody and try to do that no matter where we stand in terms of our beliefs.
John Gustav Rothel, president of Affirmation. It's a support group for gay and lesbian Mormons. John, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Kendall Wilcox, director of the ongoing film project Far Between and the founder of the Empathy First Initiative. Thanks for being with us and sharing those clips with us as well.
Thank you, Doug. And next time I'm going to ask you what you thought of this policy.
How dare you? John DeLynn, psychologist, creator of the podcast Mormon Stories. Thank you for coming down.
Thanks, Doug.
Talking to us. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.